Wondery Plus subscribers can listen to Tides of History early and ad-free right now. Join Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or Apple Podcasts.
The old sailor closed his eyes and felt the warm summer gusts rustle his long, unkempt beard. Gray predominated, and the original black was consigned to a few stray patches here and there. The matted ruff of hair framed a deeply lined face that decades of relentless exposure to sun, wind, and spray had burned and tanned to the color and consistency of worn leather. The sailor knew these winds. Pedro had felt them all his life, as long as he could remember. That distinctive, salty tang smelled of home, too, just subtly different than anywhere else. All of that told him he had arrived at the mouth of the River Tagus, the gateway to Lisbon, just as he had so many times before. He didn't need to open his eyes to picture the scene laid out around him. A rocky shoreline with prominent, low-hanging cliffs, fishing boats pulled up outside clusters of humble fishermen's cottages like the one in which he'd been born, the river's narrow channel opening to the protected harbor beyond, the sea lane crowded with traffic, a steady procession of ships headed into and out of Lisbon. Small caravels turned south for the long journey to the coast of West Africa. Fat-bellied carracks, square sails filling with the gusting summer wind, turned north toward France and England. Pedro opened his eyes and looked down at the worn, battered ship beneath him, a caravel called the Berriu. Storms in the open waters of the Atlantic and the icy depths off the southern coast of Africa had brutalized the masts and rigging. Its sails were tattered and patched. Worms and parasites picked up in tropical African waters had eaten through the wood of the hull. The ship had first left Lisbon just over 2 years before, and it was a miracle that the Berriu could even limp into port here on July 10, 1499. Its journey had taken it more than 20,000 miles, south from Lisbon to West Africa and then to the Cape of Good Hope, then around the Cape, north and east to India before heading back the other direction. Nobody had ever made that journey before, and most of those who'd set out hadn't survived. The old sailor closed his eyes again, breathed deep, and said a silent prayer of thanks. He had seen more of the world than just about anyone alive, he thought. London and Bruges, Genoa and Naples, Mozambique and Calicut, the Congo River and the Rhine. This was enough. Nothing would ever top this last voyage. A small fishing boat passed by the Berriu, its two-man crew hauling on the lines draped over the side. The sight of it and the slight whiff of fresh-caught fish reminded Pedro of his childhood. Maybe he should get himself a little boat and finish his days hauling in the occasional catch. After all, what else was there for Pedro to see? Hi, everybody. From Wondery, welcome to another episode of Tides of History. I'm Patrick Wyman. Thanks for joining me. The end of the 15th century saw the beginning of the Age of Exploration. Ships set out from Europe, bound west across the Atlantic, landing in the Americas, south along the coast of Africa, east to India, the Spice Islands, China, and Japan. These slow, tentative, haphazard, often disastrous and rarely successful efforts marked the first steps toward the European global domination that peaked some 400 years later, at the end of the 19th century. We've talked about these early voyages of exploration before here on Tides, focusing on the medieval routes of the famous expeditions that everyone knows about, Columbus, Da Gama, and so on. I thought it was time to return to the topic and take a fresh look. Today, we're going to follow the life of a composite character, a sailor named Pedro, to help us understand this seemingly sudden explosion at the end of the 15th century. Over the course of Pedro's life, the scope of the known maritime world drastically changed, and this humble sailor had a front-row seat to that whole process. What currents pulled Pedro? What winds drove him on from the outskirts of Lisbon to beyond the edge of the known world? Today's episode follows along with our last couple of installments. Usually, I use composite characters to illustrate a theme, to personalize and ground large-scale developments in something understandable, the life of a person. But in these episodes, we're reversing it. We're starting with the person and then letting the major themes flow outward from there, This is maybe a touch closer to historical fiction, but I think it's a valuable exercise for understanding people's lives in a granular, detailed way. So we're going to keep using it. Even if they're a composite character, a work of fiction, they reveal something real about the time in which they're set. That's both my reasoning and my disclaimer. So let's meet our friend Pedro. He was born around 1440 in a fishing village just outside Lisbon, facing out toward the frothing, raging waters of the open Atlantic. Pedro's father, Diogo, and the rest of the men in their village set out in their small boats, single-masted, open vessels. Mostly, they fished with lines near to shore in the estuary of the Tagus, but occasionally Pedro's father ranged further afield, north along the coast and south toward Morocco. This could be dangerous. Fishermen who ventured into unfriendly waters might end up dead or taken captive, sold in the slave markets of the Muslim world, places like Algiers and Tunis or even further. This was the very edge of Europe, a long way from the centers of maritime trade and capital that dominated most of the Middle Ages. We've spent a lot of time on this show talking about places like Venice, London, Bruges, and even Seville. Mostly, it's because that's where the money was. The major axes of European commerce ran across the Mediterranean, connected Italy to southern Germany, the Rhineland, the Low Countries, and London, and tied the North Sea to the Baltic. By contrast, we haven't featured Lisbon nearly as prominently. It's not that the Atlantic seaboard was irrelevant. The Atlantic coast saw more and more traffic as the Middle Ages went on, tying together Genoa, Barcelona, and Seville to the ports of northern Europe by sea. Lisbon was a key stopover on that journey, and it was also a player in regional trade in its own right. Every year, ships traveled from Lisbon and Porto to trading hubs on the coast of England and elsewhere to the north, places like Bristol, Hull, London, and Bruges. One Portuguese merchant brought his carrack from Portugal to Southampton four times in 1433 alone, for example. Communities of expatriate Portuguese merchants popped up in every one of the major trading ports of northern Europe. Cargoes like honey, olive oil, dates, hides, and especially wine filled the holds of Portuguese ships bound for those ports. Plenty of English and Flemish merchants headed south, too, almost entirely carrying cloth. Florentine, Genoese, and Venetian ships, not to mention French, Castilian, Basque, and Catalan vessels hailing from closer still, stopped in as well. The sea lanes stretching around the western extremities of Europe were increasingly filled with traffic as the 15th century wore on. Larger cargoes on bigger ships and more of them. Pedro's father and his small fishing boat, open to the ravages of the wind and sea, slipped in among them without much notice. Like Pedro's father, his grandfather, named João, likewise made his living from the sea, but initially as a merchant sailor rather than a fisherman. João crewed ships out of Lisbon bound all along the Atlantic coast, and he knew the sea lanes to Southampton, Harfleur, and Bruges like the back of his hand. Often he worked on Portuguese ships, but he slipped easily into this international maritime world. In 1407, working for a Portuguese merchant named Nicolau Eanes, he shipped Portuguese wine to England and Ireland on a ship called the Catarina, which ultimately came from the Hanseatic port of Gdansk in the Baltic. João completed that trip by coming home on an English ship chartered by a different Portuguese merchant. Pedro's grandfather traveled far and wide in his youth before settling back down near Lisbon, working as a fisherman. João's son, Diogo, was born in 1415. This was Pedro's world, a maritime world. That year, 1415, was the key date in expanding Portuguese horizons. Sure, the Portuguese nobility had their lands and castles, their war horses, and their game parks to hunt in. Peasants planted grain, tended vineyards and olive groves, kept livestock. But practically nowhere in Portugal was far from the sea, and the kings and nobles of Portugal realized pretty early on that their fates and future advancement were tied to the Atlantic and the possibilities it offered. The first official, permanent commercial treaty between the kings of England and Portugal was signed in 1308. A semi-permanent naval force followed soon after that. Portuguese kings actively collected revenue from mercantile activities and later played a key role in maritime adventuring. On top of that, the advancing crown of Castile basically cut off the Portuguese kings from further conquests in southern Spain after the middle of the 13th century. If they wanted to pursue glory and reap the material rewards of warfare, as all medieval nobles did, it would have to come at sea. Their opportunity came in the form of Ceuta, a Muslim-held city on the coast of North Africa, just to the east of the Straits of Gibraltar. On July 26, 1415, soon after Diogo's birth, João sailed out of the estuary of the River Tagus, along with thousands upon thousands of other Portuguese. This was the largest armada, carrying the largest army, that a Portuguese king had ever assembled up to that point. 19,000 soldiers in all, dozens of chartered or requisitioned merchant ships, war galleys owned by the royal family. João didn't know where they were going, and the destination was a mystery to practically all the knights, foot soldiers, and sailors assembled in the summer heat. Only later did it become clear that they were bound for Ceuta, a key trading port and naval base often used by the Moroccan corsairs who plagued the region. Following a massive gunpowder artillery bombardment that João would never forget, Prince Henry, later famous as Henry the Navigator, led a suicidally brave frontal assault on the well-fortified city, capturing it after 13 hours of brutal, bloody fighting. The Portuguese nobility had their crusading victory and their chivalric glory, and the Portuguese crown now had a lucrative foothold in North Africa. João returned home to Lisbon and his newborn son, Diogo, and resumed the life of a fisherman. His son followed in his footsteps, sticking close to home and the rhythms of the sea and the catch. But as João aged, hauling in the fishing lines with scarred, calloused hands and maneuvering his small boat around the fisheries of the Portuguese coast with young Diogo at his side, the world was growing larger around them. Tales reached their fishing village of the Azore Islands out to the west, the Canary Islands to the south off the African coast, and what lay still further beyond. They saw the occasional lean caravels with their distinctive triangular sails returning from exploratory journeys down the Saharan coast of West Africa. That was in addition to the more regular sight of predatory corsairs returning home from plundering Muslim shipping in towns along the Moroccan shoreline. Unlike his father and many of the professional sailors in their village in the vicinity of Lisbon, young Diogo was never tempted to go out on these freebooting or exploring expeditions. He liked being a fisherman. He enjoyed his little village and his profusion of uncles, aunts, and cousins. The stories of new and faraway lands hidden beyond the horizon didn't stir an urge to travel or explore. Predictability was what Diogo wanted, a humble, regular life. He married a distant cousin from the next fishing village over and had a son in 1440, our friend Pedro. But as was so often the case in this age, death went along with life. Pedro's mother died giving birth to their second child, a little girl, who likewise didn't survive. Unusually, Diogo never remarried. His wife's death broke his heart, and he couldn't bear the thought of replacing her. It was just Diogo and Pedro in their tiny whitewashed home, one of a tight cluster rising up on a rocky hillside immediately above the frothing waters of the Atlantic. Yet young Pedro's existence was far from solitary. His village was full of relatives. His grandmother and grandfather lived two houses away. Aunts and uncles and cousins were all around, and Pedro never lacked for company. As soon as he was able, he went out on the water with his father and grandfather, learning the rhythms and feel of the sea. He could sense a storm coming from the scent on the breeze, grasp the direction of the current, and understand the perils and the possibilities of the wind. Pedro loved his village, and his childhood was full of happy memories and experiences. Thick, delicious seafood stews shared around a rough-hewn wooden table with a gaggle of relatives, games played with cousins in the narrow lanes between whitewashed homes, the sound of the winter rain pounding on tile roofs. But what young Pedro enjoyed most were his grandfather's stories. João told him about the blast of the cannon at Ceuta, the impossible green of an Irish hillside, the bustling seaports of the English Channel. Pedro ate up these tales, and as he grew into adolescence and then young adulthood, the same kind of wanderlust seized him. He decided he wanted to go to sea. That was a natural enough choice for someone raised in a maritime world, but Pedro didn't want to be a fisherman like his father. Instead, he wanted to see the world. He would get more than he ever bargained for, more than even his well-traveled grandfather had ever imagined was possible.
If you travel, you know how to pull off a perfect getaway. You know after you enroll with your Delta SkyMiles Platinum American Express card, you get up to $10 back monthly on U.S. rideshare purchases with select providers, like a car to the airport. You know which remote retreats have the best herbal baths, and where the Wi-Fi password is rarely used. because you're the escape artist. It's why you're a Delta SkyMiles Platinum American Express card member. If you travel, you know. Terms apply. Purchases must be on card. Visit go.amex/you know.
Pedro was 16 years old when he arrived on the docks of Lisbon in 1456, a bright-eyed youth ready to expand his horizons. He already knew more about the sailor's life than a lot of grown men. He'd spent his whole life on boats, hauling in lines and generally acquainting himself with the rhythms and feel of a life spent working at sea. It wasn't hard for him to get a berth on a large ship owned by a merchant of Lisbon, a man named Martim Leme. One of his uncles knew the ship's sailing master, and good recruits were always in demand. Lisbon was a thriving port. Its merchant community was well-connected and flush with capital. I mentioned before that the king and nobility were deeply involved in maritime ventures. Prince Henry the Navigator, son, brother, and then uncle of Portuguese kings, is famous now for funding and sponsoring voyages down the coast of Africa, but most of his maritime investments were actually in corsairing voyages, glorified piracy with a superficially religious justification. In theory, corsairs were supposed to target the plentiful Muslim shipping and trade off the coast of Morocco. In practice, they were happy to attack Christian vessels as well. Beyond their direct funding, the Portuguese royals and the nobility more broadly were tightly tied to Lisbon's merchants, who paid for monopolies and privileges and generally exercised influence over commercial policy. Merchants' sons and daughters married nobles' illegitimate children, cementing ties between the royal household and the well-heeled merchants of the city. All of this represented a source of ready cash for the king and an avenue of capital investment in all directions. Relationships greased the wheels of commerce and made this tightly connected rich richer. This was the environment that produced work as a sailor for Pedro. It was wealthy, cosmopolitan, and fundamentally oriented toward the Atlantic Ocean and the possibilities it offered. The thriving commerce and deeply rooted maritime culture of Lisbon in particular, and Portugal more generally, were what set the stage for the famous voyages that took our friend from Europe to distant India with Vasco da Gama in 1497. I mentioned a moment ago that Pedro found work on a ship owned by a merchant named Martim Leme. Leme was only a second-generation resident of Lisbon. His father, Martin Lemes, had immigrated to Portugal from Flanders, and their family retained their commercial connections to the north. I mention this because it was by no means unusual. Lisbon's merchant community was incredibly cosmopolitan and deeply tied to the other commercial centers of Europe. As a result, it wasn't surprising that Bruges was where Pedro headed on his first long trip away from home, a 16-year-old sailor learning his craft. The ship on which Pedro traveled north was a large, two-masted, square-sailed type known as a carrack, with enough room for more than 100 tons of cargo. Wine barrels, in this case, in the hold. The carrack had appeared on the scene only recently. With its high castles at the bow and stern, its two masts, its effective rudder, and smooth, caulked planking. It was a marvel of late medieval ship design, a vast improvement on its predecessors in speed, seaworthiness, and range. Pedro's first long voyage went off without a hitch, delivering the wine and picking up a cargo of fine Flemish cloth for the return voyage. Within months, Pedro had a full round trip under his belt. After a few days at home, seeing his family, he shipped out again. This time, he was heading out into the ocean to the west, where the newly settled Atlantic islands of the Azores. This was a substantial trip, some 850 miles in each direction, and it unsettled Pedro at first. Once they lost sight of the Portuguese coast, there was nothing but open water in every direction for hundreds of miles. The discovery and settlement of the Azores was one essential step on the road to global exploration. Familiarity with the more distant reaches of the Atlantic gave Portuguese mariners a sense of both the possibilities and the limitations of further navigation. It told them about the winds and currents, about what their ships could and couldn't do, what the storms and dangers were, and what they might find, the incentives that made trips like this worthwhile. Increasingly regular traffic toward the Azores and the African coast to the south also provided a pool of well-trained sailors to crew the ships. Pedro was becoming part of that pool of talent. Lisbon merchants like Martim Leme drew on this pool, employing Pedro and the other sailors of the city for trips to a variety of destinations. The extensive commercial connections that made the merchants rich, and both directly and indirectly the Portuguese royals, were built on a material infrastructure of skilled labor. This was the same pool of talent and skill that enabled long-distance exploration. Over the next decade, Pedro traversed the entirety of the commercial network centered on Lisbon. He worked on relatively small ships with just a few crewmen, plying the nearby coastal routes to Porto and the Basque coast of northern Spain. The great trading centers of the western Mediterranean world opened to him. Seville, Barcelona, Marseille, Genoa, and Naples, sailing on big carracks and fat-bellied cogs. He headed north again multiple times, going to Southampton, Bristol, London, Harfleur, Bruges, Antwerp, and once even to the Hansa port of Hamburg, traveling on an enormous merchantman whose home port was distant Gdansk. He headed north again multiple times, going to Southampton, Bristol, London, Harfleur, Bruges, Antwerp, and once even to the Hansa port of Hamburg, traveling on an enormous merchantman whose home port was distant Riga. He touched the edges of the Muslim world in ports like Malaga, Ceuta, and Algiers, often traveling in the lean, swift, maneuverable new ships known as caravels. More on them shortly. The Azores showed up on his itinerary twice more. He unloaded cargoes of wine, dates, fresh fruit, hides, cloth, wool, iron, timber, pitch, grain, pottery, and sugar. Sugar was becoming a bigger and bigger product, especially as produced on large-scale plantations on the Azores. The Baltic and Iceland were still a bit beyond his horizons, and he never made it to Venice or the eastern Mediterranean, but otherwise, Pedro saw most of the known world from the deck of a ship. Most, that was, except for what lay to the south. Africa. That was the next frontier, slowly becoming visible from the docks of Lisbon, and Africa was where Pedro would go next. Now, the coast of Africa wasn't a total mystery in the 1460s. The first voyages past the Straits of Gibraltar that turned left, going south into the unknown, began with Genoese ships in the late 13th century. By the middle of the 14th century, the Canary Islands off the Saharan coast had firmly entered the realm of the known, and Madeira and the Azores followed soon after. Pedro had already been there, as we discussed. But he'd never gone further south, with the increasing stream of Portuguese ships seeking their fortune along the African coast. In point of fact, purely exploratory voyages were a sideshow at this point. Prince Henry the Navigator, Dom Henrique, as he was known at the time, was much more interested in burnishing his reputation as a crusader, plundering Muslim ships and ports, and hopefully conquering the Canary Islands, than in learning more about the lands to the south. Glory, both religious and chivalric, and profit were the goals. Henry's exploratory efforts leveraged all his available political power, including contacts with the Pope, in the pursuit of both. How could exploration lead to profit? In a couple of different ways. One of the things the Portuguese, and Europeans more generally, knew about Africa was that it was where gold came from. The ports of North Africa, places like Ceuta, Algiers, and Tunis, were the endpoints of the caravan routes that brought gold from the streams and rivers of West Africa across the Sahara, where it entered circulation. The precise mechanisms by which the gold was panned or mined in the first place and then reached these outposts of the Muslim mercantile world weren't clear to Europeans, but they knew the ultimate source of the gold lay to the south. A few Europeans actually made it across the Sahara, but they never succeeded in making a dent in the gold trade. Going by sea made far more sense, and finding the source of the gold was the overriding goal of the exploratory expeditions Henry funded. Conquering the Canaries would be great press for Henry as a chivalric prince, but they would also serve as a wonderful base for future attempts to find the origin of the gold. As it happened, Henry never succeeded in taking the islands, despite substantial investments of money and manpower. These goals of enrichment and glorification went hand in hand, powering a slow, torturous advance down the coast of West Africa. Until the source of the gold could be found, slave trading sufficed to pay the bills. Human trafficking was already a deeply rooted part of both the economy and the society in Saharan Africa, and the Portuguese simply tapped into already existing networks of slave trading to make their expeditions profitable. It took until the mid-1450s until Portuguese ships finally got past the southern reaches of the Sahara. Henry and his associates employed experienced Italian navigators, a Genoese named Antonio Neto Uso di Mare and a Venetian named Alvise da Cadamosto, to make this major breakthrough. At last, the expeditions had reached the estuaries of the Senegal and Gambia rivers, places where gold, ivory, slaves, and peppers could be found in great quantities. Whatever the interest in genuine exploration, the money was now present to make all this effort worthwhile. The profits would start rolling in, and the scale of the trade and its importance skyrocketed. Portugal was a marginal power by any European standard, cut off from expansion within the Iberian Peninsula and hamstrung beyond Ceuta in North Africa by its lack of serious resources and manpower. Sure, Portuguese fidalgos, nobles, might go and do some religious violence in Ceuta's hinterland, but they were never going to carve out a major crusader state on the other side of the Straits of Gibraltar. Options were limited. But, with that said, Portugal was a maritime powerhouse. Corsairing was profitable. More importantly, Lisbon sat right at the meeting point of the Atlantic and Mediterranean commercial economies, just at the seam of two wealthy, expansive, and expanding worlds, with access to the resources and manpower of both. The merchants of Lisbon were nobody's fools. They had plenty of access to capital and expertise. Portuguese shipbuilding, navigation, and gunpowder artillery were right on the cutting edge of what was possible in the 15th century. Finally, and this is where our friend Pedro enters the story of long-distance exploration and trade, there was a substantial pool of trained manpower available to do the difficult work of sailing through unfamiliar waters a long way from home. I mentioned before that progress under Prince Henry, who held an effective monopoly on southward trade and exploration, was slow, haphazard, and inefficient. It took Henry until 1455 to secure a papal bull that gave his monopoly real force. The Portuguese crown could thus enforce serious penalties for anybody violating the monopoly, which made it far more likely that they'd actually pay for a royal license to do trading there. In 1460, for example, one interloper caught trading off the coast of Senegal without buying a royal license was captured and taken to Lisbon, where he was publicly tortured on the wheel and then burned to death. That was a far more fearsome penalty than paying a minor fine. With increasing profitability and the monopoly secure, things sped up dramatically toward the end of the 1460s. Ironically, after the death of Prince Henry the Navigator. The major turning point came in 1469, when the Portuguese crown sold a large part of its African monopoly to a Lisbon merchant named Fernão Gomes. We know precious little about Fernão Gomes, which is a shame. He must have been both wealthy and tightly connected to the royal household in order to get such a plum prize, and at such a low price. He paid 200,000 reis per year, roughly the cost of 25 slaves and amounting to just 0.4% of the Portuguese crown revenues, which were already pretty low compared to other European rulers. Gomes, like all the profit-oriented investors of this period, went about exploiting his control of the market with aplomb. Instead of selling individual licenses, as the Portuguese crown had done, Gomes put together large annual fleets to sail south, trade on a large scale, and continue exploring further down the coast. More than 20 ships at a time headed south, convoys stocked with trade goods to exchange for valuable luxuries along the African shoreline. These represented a sizable capital outlay and required a ton of manpower. Enter our friend Pedro, a skilled sailor operating out of Fernão Gomes' home port. In 1470, the first year Fernão Gomes sent a fleet south, Pedro was 30 years old and had been a professional sailor for half his life. He knew the taverns and wine shops that sailors of his sort frequented. They talked about their voyages and discussed everything from the tricks of the winds and currents to where the best and cleanest brothels might be found in Bristol, Seville, and Genoa. These places were information clearinghouses, and word filtered through about what was happening to the south. Africa was opening up, and perhaps it was time for Pedro to head in that direction. While not a specialist pilot or a soldier, handy with a sword, cannon, or crossbow in hostile waters, workers who knew their way around the difficult technical skills required to crew a carrack or caravel on a long voyage were valuable as well. Probably financed by Genoese investors, Gomes paid well. That was enough for Pedro. He signed up. The next frontier was waiting.
If you travel for work, you know to pack two suits, business and swim. You know with your Delta SkyMiles Business Amex card, buying that plane ticket for a business trip can get you closer to medallion status. You know that a meeting in Montana means visiting almost every national park.
Yellowstone? Check.
Because you're the chief excursion officer. It's why you're a Delta SkyMiles Platinum Business American Express card member. If you travel, you know. Terms apply. Visit go.amex/you-know-business.
If I asked you how many subscriptions you have, would you be able to list all of them and how much you're paying? If you would have asked me this question before I started using Rocket Money, I would have said yes. But let me tell you, I would have been so wrong. I can't believe how many I had and all the money I was wasting. Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has helped save its members an average of $720 a year with over 500 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/Wondery. That's rocketmoney.com/Wondery. rocketmoney.com/Wondery.
Despite Pedro's itinerant life and traveling the sea lanes of the Atlantic world, the sailor still returned home as often as he could. He had married a few years before to a cousin who lived in the next fishing village over and had a baby daughter. Another baby, a son, had died in infancy, as was so often the case. Patterns like this were common. The fishing villages along the coastline shared people between them, connected by tight local networks of marriage, kinship, a common occupational maritime culture, and employment. Lisbon, the major port, lay at the center of it all. They all knew each other, forming their own little world. In the spring of 1470, Pedro bid farewell to his village, his wife, and baby daughter, his father, now 55 years old but still an active fisherman, and his grandfather, pushing 80 years of age but still active and hearty. Taking a small boat down the coast to Lisbon, he boarded a caravel in the bustling harbor. The ship's triangular sails filled with wind on the way out of the Tagus estuary, billowing in the warming breeze. A hard turn to port pointed the ship south, toward waters Pedro didn't yet know, toward the future of exploration and trade. The point of furthest navigation when Pedro set off south was probably somewhere in present-day Sierra Leone or perhaps Liberia, just before or at the point where the African coast turns from generally pointing north-south to east-west. This was the end of the great bulge that projects out into the Atlantic. The pace of exploration along the African coast had been glacially slow for most of the 15th century. Sailing conditions were unfamiliar and difficult, there were few bases to provide safe harbors and resupply along the way, and most important, there was no guarantee of profitability. But the trip south was getting easier than it had over the past few decades. The first voyage funded by Fernão Gomes, the expedition on which our friend Pedro was now traveling, marked a massive expansion and quickening of the pace. The island of Madeira, out in the Atlantic between Portugal and the northwest coast of Africa, offered a respite on the first leg of the voyage. Pedro had been there before, just once, transporting sugar. After that, though, things got unfamiliar, at least for him. Other sailors in the fleet, a dozen ships, sails billowing in the hot breeze blowing in from the Sahara, had made the trip before. They guided the caravels and carracks past the Canary Islands, then through the treacherous shoals and currents off the Sahara. It was a long journey, one of the longest Pedro had ever made, the coastline empty except for rocks, dunes, and the occasional Berber encampment or tiny village. The lone Portuguese outpost at Arguim, about halfway down the coast, was their sole safe harbor along the way. Finally, the flotilla turned west into the Atlantic, a short hop away from the dry Sahara to the Cape Verde Islands. The settlements here were sparsely populated and new, less than a decade old, but they were the perfect place to resupply, take on food and water, and make necessary repairs before continuing the voyage. When they turned back to the east, the terrain was changing. Trees and lush greenery, a wall of dense forest, replaced the desolate Saharan coastline. Pedro sweated in the tropical heat and marveled at the sounds of the jungle as the ships anchored at the mouth of a great river, the Gambia, where they did some trading with the locals. Cloth and metal implements for ivory and a little bit of gold. They went a bit further, past the Rio Grande of Guinea-Bissau, and then to what's now Sierra Leone and Liberia.
before they had collected all the cargo they could fit. Ivory was one. They acquired gold, too, but still had not reached a particularly good source of it. But the most important trade good was slaves. It's not an exaggeration to say that voyages of trade and exploration like this one wouldn't have happened if the sale of enslaved people hadn't financed them. Finally, after months spent along the coast, the fleet turned back north, returning home to Lisbon via Cape Verde and Madeira. Pedro boarded another small boat in the harbor and headed back home to his village, where he got to see his family, fathers, cousins, uncles, and of course his wife and daughter. Pedro's grandfather, João, now a sprightly 80 years old, were a long-lived family, delighted in hearing stories of what Pedro had seen on his voyage south. The jagged Saharan coastline, masked Berbers, thick tropical jungle, the strange, to him and his Portuguese fellows, customs and appearance of the people who lived at the mouth of the Gambia, the little nuggets of raw, pure gold. Old João was entranced, and it took a great deal of persuading to stop him from boarding a boat to Lisbon and trying to find work on a ship headed south himself. Pedro passed the winter of 1470 at home, but when spring came, he once again left his family behind and headed for Lisbon. Fernão Gomes had made a huge amount of money from his first year of the Africa trade, thanks to gold, ivory, and slaves, and was putting together an even larger fleet for 1471. Once again, Pedro had no trouble finding a berth on one of the ships, a brand new caravel built right in Lisbon, and this time he brought along a few cousins who were also looking for well-paying work. The trip south was a little more familiar this time, a little less alien. The same faces cropped up, faces Pedro came to know well. They were experienced sailors like himself, and they were growing into a group that specialized in the African trade. One of them was the pilot Pedro Escobar, one of the more daring and experienced navigators traveling with the fleet, and it was on his vessel that Pedro sailed. This voyage was easier than the first time, and the sights were more familiar. The profit-focused merchants knew where it was worthwhile to stop and trade and where it wasn't. Even more than that, they were determined, especially the skilled navigators, to keep pushing past the last known point on the coastline to see what possibilities lay beyond. There had to be more gold out there, a better access point closer to the still unknown mines, where they could find a whole stream rather than the dribs and drabs that leaked out further to the west and north. Pedro and his compatriots found it on this voyage at what became known as El Mina, literally the mine, located in what's now Ghana, a few hundred miles beyond the previous furthest point of navigation. There was already a thriving gold trade here, carried out by native, Arab, and Berber traders, and the Portuguese simply hopped in. This was where the real money started to roll into the enterprise. Still further they went, well into the Gulf of Guinea, traveling past mangrove swamps and the vast, complex delta of the Niger River before turning around and coming back home. They went again the next year and the next, sighting the islands of the Gulf, São Tomé and Príncipe, and spotting the southward turn of the coastline in what's now Cameroon and Gabon. The African trade was becoming profitable and intriguing to the Portuguese royals and the merchants of Lisbon. Investors made large amounts of profit, and even sailors like Pedro made good wages and some money by trading on their own account. He acquired a little monkey and a parrot on the Guinea coast and brought them home to his village, where they lived alongside his little daughter. After 1475, the Portuguese crown took back its monopoly from Fernão Gomes, but that was less a government takeover of private enterprise than a reorganization of the close ties between the Portuguese crown and the merchant community. Gomes had already gotten rich, and he stayed involved. Many of the captains, navigators and sailors who had worked for Gomes had worked for the royal household before the merchant's monopoly and continued doing so afterward. What we can see here is a milieu in which royal political power and influence, private capital, a pool of technical knowledge, and a skilled labor force all converged in the business of the West African trade. The biggest impetus for the switch back to direct royal control was war between the neighboring Kingdom of Castile and Portugal, part of a succession war over the rule of Castile. Pedro and his compatriots didn't much care about that, but it directly impacted them when they had to fight a battle against a Castilian fleet off the coast of Guinea in 1478. That battle ended well for Pedro and his compatriots. Another Castilian fleet, one with a large component of hired Flemings, showed up the following year. Like the first, that one ended in Portuguese victory as well. The ship on which Pedro was serving on that particular voyage was captained by a minor nobleman and experienced sea captain named Diogo Cao. Cao knew his business, both war and exploration, and forged a tight relationship with the navigator Pedro Escobar, whom our friend Pedro already knew. When Cao and Escobar went looking for sailors for a long voyage in 1482, a voyage of true exploration down the African coast, Pedro was a natural choice. This expedition went south past the equator and explored the coasts of the Congo and Angola, leaving behind large carved stone pillars called padrões to mark their passage. Another voyage followed in 1485, and this time they turned inland at the River Congo, exploring as far as their ships could take them before reaching the Yalala Falls. Pedro and his companions left behind an inscription that still survives to this day, some 90 miles from the ocean. When Pedro returned home to his village after this epic voyage into the heart of Africa, he was saddened to hear that his grandfather had finally passed away, aged almost 90. He would have loved to hear the story of the trip up the Congo, Pedro thought, and the memory stayed with him as he traveled south time after time over the next decade. He heard that an expedition had even succeeded in rounding the southern tip of Africa, but no further voyages set out for a while. Pedro settled into an annual rhythm as a sailor skilled in the winds and currents of West Africa. The trade was lucrative, the pay was good. Aside from the risk of catching a tropical disease or a sudden storm, it was safe enough as these things went. Finally, early in 1497, Pedro heard that a long-distance voyage was setting out to go past what Bartolomeu Dias had done a decade before, seeking the full route to India. He was nearly 60 years old. His daughter was grown and married herself to yet another sailor who lived in their village and worked the Africa and Atlantic Island routes. He had three grandchildren, all of them living near his home. His wife had passed on a few years before from cancer, but his old father, almost 85 years old, was still around. Old Diogo spent his days sitting out and watching the fishing boats come and go, telling stories to his great-grandchildren and the other youth of the village. Pedro figured he had little to lose and one more frontier to cross. His old friend, Pedro Escobar, was the pilot on a workhorse caravel called the Berrio. Other veterans of the voyages of trade and exploration were likewise aboard. Pedro knew most of them, even if their leader, Vasco da Gama, was a newcomer. For more than 2 years they traveled, braving both Atlantic ice and driving storms and the sweltering heat of the Indian Ocean. They heard unintelligible new tongues and saw things they never could have imagined, everywhere from the Cape of Good Hope to Malindi to Mozambique to Calicut. They saw terrible violence, much of it inflicted by their trigger-happy, borderline psychotic commander, Vasco da Gama. They spent weeks becalmed and not moving on a glassy sea, enough to drive them mad. The terrible affliction of scurvy set in. The sailors lost teeth, old wounds reopened, their gums bled, many died. Only two of the four ships survived the journey, and it took all of Pedro's knowledge and toughness to make it back home. That's where we first met our friend, back at the beginning of today's episode. He had a front row seat on the expanding edge of Europe for decades, and he had seen everything there was to see. After the Berrio docked in Lisbon, Pedro found a small coastal lugger to take him back to his village. He was exhausted, worn down to whipcord thinness, his beard wild and matted, his face burnt and windblown to the consistency of old leather. But as the lugger pulled into the small protected harbor, he looked up at the whitewashed houses. There was his old father, sitting in a chair, precisely where he'd been 2 years before. Old Diogo smiled and waved, yelling back over his shoulder. Pedro waved back. He saw his daughter appear, a new baby on her arm, a pair of grandsons shouting and laughing at the sight of him. Well, what stories he would tell them, he thought, just as his grandfather had filled his head with tales of far-off ports and exotic places. Perhaps one day, they might go even further than him, then return home to the fishing village themselves with stories of their own. As humble as it was, Pedro's fishing village sat at the heart of the Age of Discovery. Ships don't sail without sailors. They don't sail far and into new, unknown waters without sailors who know what they're doing. Maritime communities were repositories of skilled labor and information, a wealth of knowledge and talent that powered the whole drive from Europe out into the Atlantic and then the Indian Ocean. Add some technological innovation, some political incentives, and a healthy injection of investment capital, and the formula was clear. But we shouldn't forget about the technical skills and the spirit of adventure that shaped Pedro and other humble sailors. Knowledge passed down from grandfather to grandson, generations of stories about the sea and its possibilities. That's part of the formula for maritime exploration and commercial expansion, too. And we should give Pedro some credit. Next time on Tides of History, we're going to be shifting our focus east, back toward the Ottoman Empire. It's been a while since we've checked in with the most powerful and expansive state of the day, and we'll track their rise from the conquest of Constantinople to the doorstep of Central Europe. Until then, thanks so much for joining. Be sure and hit me up if you'd like to chat about anything we've talked about on Tides, or something you'd like to see. You can find me on Twitter at @Patrick_Wyman, or on Facebook at @PatrickWymanMMA. You can follow the show at Tides History. If you haven't already, don't forget to subscribe to Tides of History on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, Stitcher, or wherever you're listening to this right now. If you've been enjoying the show, I'd really appreciate it if you left a 5-star rating and a review. Tides of History is written and narrated by me, Patrick Wyman. The sound design is by Derek Behrens for Airship. The sound engineer is Sergio Enriquez. Tides of History is produced by Morgan Jaffe. From Wondery, the executive producers are Hernan Lopez and Leah Sutherland. Thanks again for listening. Until next time, from Wondery, this has been Tides of History.
Welcome to the small town of Chinook, where faith runs deep and secrets run deeper. In this new thriller, available exclusively on Wondery Plus, religion and crime collide when a gruesome murder rocks the isolated Montana community. Everyone is quick to point their fingers at a drug-addicted teenager, but local deputy Ruth Vogel isn't convinced. She suspects connections to a powerful religious group. Enter federal agent V.B. Loro, who has been investigating a local church for possible criminal activity. The pair form an unlikely partnership to catch the killer, unearthing secrets that leave Ruth torn between her duty to the law, her religious convictions, and her very own family. But something more sinister than murder is afoot, and someone is watching Ruth. With an all-star cast led by Emmy nominee Sanaa Lathan and Star Wars Kelly Marie Tran, Chinook is available exclusively and ad-free on Wondery Plus. Join Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or on Apple Podcasts.